Welcome to the Box Seat Podcast. You're looking to Husky Athletics and anything and everything sports related. I'm Alec Dietz.
I'm Andy Amashta.
And I'm Chris Ankiko.
And today we're going to go over some topics that were of interest to us over the last week. First and foremost, we'll get into what we thought of Monday's college football national championship game between Alabama and Georgia, followed by a discussion of some of the high-profile transfers the Huskies have brought in and may be looking to bring in football. Then we'll check in on the UW men's basketball team and recap its most recent game against Washington State, plus we'll preview some of the matchups ahead. Shifting gears into pro sports, we'll predict, probably incorrectly, the four NFL divisional games this weekend, discuss the house cleaning of the Seattle Seahawks coaching staff, and then transition to some points of interest in the NBA, including the exploits and blunders of UW's own Isaiah Thomas. Andy will recap the weekend soccer, and we'll end the show talking about the retirement of Dubs as the UW mascot. Now that we have that out of the way, let's jump right into the big sports event of the week, the national championship game between Alabama and Georgia. And for this topic, we have our first special guest of the pod. It's our wonderful, lovely sports editor, Josh Kirschenbaum. Josh, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad. All right, let's jump into it. So the Alabama Crimson Tide defeated the Georgia Bulldogs 26-23 in overtime. Tua Tagovailoa threw a 41-yard touchdown pass to Devontae Smith to give number 4 Alabama an overtime victory over Georgia. He came into the game in the second half replacing Jalen Hurts. He threw for 166 yards and 3 touchdowns. Josh, since you're our special guest, you'll talk first. What did you think?
I thought it was a really good game. I thought it started out a little slowly. I personally was a little worried about, you know, an all SEC championship game. And the way it got, the start it got off to wasn't really making, didn't seem very promising to me. But the way it ended, I mean, that the second half, the last 5 minutes going into overtime, there were just so many ups and downs in that game. Look at the overtime period. Georgia hits that 51-yard field goal. I saw it was the longest field goal in championship game history, like since the BCS started. Alabama gets the ball back, loses 16 yards on first down on a sack, and then wins the game on a touchdown on the very next play. That was just sort of the way the entire game went.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think, you know, I definitely had my concerns about an all-SEC championship game after the first time went back. I don't remember what year, but it was LSU-Alabama, and it was a blowout. It was not a fun game to watch. And I think earlier that year, those two teams played and the final score was like 9-3. So I was definitely concerned it was going to be one of those SEC type games where you're looking at, you know, a 6-3 Alabama win or a Georgia win or whatever. But the way it ended was really amazing. You know, us being on the West Coast, obviously we probably don't approve of those teams being in the championship games, but they won their semifinals. And yeah, I think Tua Tagovailoa really changed the whole course of that football game. It looked like it was going to be all Georgia until he came in. And, I mean, he made that Alabama offense score pretty much at will.
Yeah. And it looked like it was going to be all Georgia, but as you said, it was going to be all Georgia and the most, you know, SEC field goals, 13-0 at the end of the first quarter. I mean, personally, I remember that there was a 9-6 LSU over Alabama in Tuscaloosa. And I remember during the first quarter of the national championship game, I was thinking about like funny things just to tweet out, and the SEC made it, had their whole "it just means more" thing. So I was gonna say SEC football field goals just mean more. and then it went out and became the game it became. And you're right, replacing Hurts, like other than Mike Leach, I'm not sure if any head coach would do that.
No,
in a game like that, and it paid off huge dividends. So props to Saban. I guess he's pretty good at his job.
Well, and I don't, like, has Saban ever done anything like that? That sort of seems like even uncharacteristic for Nick Saban.
I mean, I think before this, the biggest risk he took was the national championship game against Texas, right? They had the onside kick.
Yeah, I remember that.
Against a Texas team that had to put in a backup quarterback after Colt McCoy got hurt.
Yeah, Garrett Gilbert.
Now, you talk about the field goals mean more thing, and it definitely meant a lot for Alabama's kicker, Andy Papanastos. Is that how you say his name?
Yep.
Is that how you say his name? He went 2-for-4, including that. I mean, the two field goals he missed were not even close.
He missed that first one, like, by an entire field, like, an upright
entire,
towards.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, Tristan Vizcaino made a game winner.
Yeah, but really, honestly, that makes up for nothing. Does not make up for his entire season, that's for sure.
And that second one, the one that would have won the game, I heard people comparing it more to Vance Odenberg at ASU, where he walked out and you could just see it.
Yeah.
Like, well, it was just lack of confidence.
Van Soderberg didn't even kick a field goal, practically. I mean, it was just like, what, he like scraped it with like the side of his foot and just barely went anywhere. Oh, it was the saddest kick I've ever seen. Like, it by a long shot.
At least it didn't get returned for a touchdown, though.
That's what I said.
There you go.
Yeah, and on the other end, Rodrigo Blankenship might have made the clutchest field goal like of all time before Alabama scored that touchdown. He made a 51-yarder for a college kicker. I mean, that's amazing.
Honestly, he's my favorite kicker just because he wears goggles during the game. I mean, that's the best thing ever. That's why he made all those field goals. But yeah, he had a very solid performance, obviously. And, you know, if not for Tua and, you know, in his efforts, Georgia would have easily taken the game and stuff.
The other thing I heard about that game sort of afterwards, there were a couple of possible controversies with the ref. There was, what was it, in the third quarter, there was that block punt that wasn't. Mm-hmm. It got called back to an offsides, and then they reviewed it and realized that there was no offsides. There were two false starts on the play, but there wasn't any offsides. I know there was a face mask call in Alabama that didn't get called.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that too. That totally killed Georgia's drive.
Yeah.
They really couldn't get anything. And that's another thing. I guess maybe, I mean, Tua did a really good job for Alabama, but the Georgia offense couldn't move the ball in the second half.
Yeah. What did we think of Fromm? Obviously, he had a pretty good first half, but then he just seemed to, like, overthrow everyone and just couldn't make any types of throws. Like, his accuracy just went out the window.
I mean, he had two interceptions, which killed drives, and I think he threw for a little over 200 yards.
Yeah, 232.
And the completion percentage didn't seem great.
Well, I think he's kind of like, Georgia's offense is a lot like UW.
Yeah.
If you don't get the ground game going, your passing game's not going to do anything. And Alabama did what Alabama did against run games. I mean, Sony Michel had 98 yards, but they really couldn't establish anything on the ground, especially when the tide started turning, pardon the pun.
Yeah, and I don't think Nick Chubb, Nick Chubb had nothing.
18 carries.
Nick Chubb did absolutely, he could not get anything going. They were trying to get him going on like reverses and stuff like that. Just nothing was working out. Michelle, he looked very, very dynamic on a lot of his carries though, even though he, you know.
Honestly, I think that started towards the end of the Rose Bowl. Michelle looked like the better back in the semifinal.
I think the change up, you know, you prepare for a guy like Nick Chubb. It, again, a lot like, you know, compare back to UW. Like, it seemed not this year, but the year previous, a lot of teams prepared for Myles Gaskin and they got a healthy dose of LeVon Coleman and he would erupt. So they sort of had that going for him. And I think that's what happened with Michelle and Chubb.
Did anybody call Riley Ridley being the best Ridley in this game?
No.
Six receptions for 82 yards for Georgia while his brother, how did Calvin Ridley do?
He got that touchdown at the end of the game, and that was big, and I think that was the first play he made all game.
They're actually brothers? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I did not know that. That's kind of a fun tidbit.
Yeah, I think they swapped jerseys at the end of the game.
So. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I saw that.
I see.
On Instagram, ESPN.
Yeah, that was good to see.
Seemed like Georgia's offensive star really was Mecole Hardman. He did a lot of stuff with, like, motioning into the backfield. I remember on one of the touchdowns was, like, Fromm and Hardman switched places, and Hardman became the quarterback. And he did like a fake, did a read option thing, and just bolted to the left side of the end zone.
That was straight out of Penn State's playbook. I know they ran that with Barkley and McSorley a couple times.
They did, yeah. Well, except Fromm wasn't in the backfield, which is just crazy that Penn State can do that. Apparently, I was talking to a beat reporter from Penn State, and they said they had Saquon Barkley line up in the shotgun as the quarterback, and Trace McSorley lined up as the running back, and Barkley would give the ball to McSorley at certain points in the year, which is just nuts.
But like the sort of the trickeration of like the fanciness of Georgia's offense sort of did them in toward the end. I remember one of their like three and out drives. It was toward the end. They did the whole Hardman read option thing. It didn't work out. They did like a Chubb reverse. I think they had one other sort of weird play. And I was just thinking like, you know, this is getting way too fancy. Tua is just too much on a roll, you know, to try out these new things. You just got to stick with a ground game or something.
No. Fancy play call, overly aggressive play call in a championship game. You're thinking of the Falcons.
Oh,
yeah.
You might be right. And it's the same city, so.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, man, how rough would it be to be a Georgia fan at all? To be at the championship stage in the Super Bowl, blow a 28-3 lead, and then lose a game like this against Alabama in your home state. That's rough.
Honestly,
in your home stadium.
Let's expand on that. How rough is it to be, like, a Georgia sports fan in general?
Yeah.
Like the Falcons, the Braves.
The Hawks are awful.
The Hawks, yeah, exactly. There's just been so much heartbreak.
Hey, they're baseball town.
Yeah.
The
good news is that the Thrashers also sucked, but then they got rid of them, so.
I did kind of want to talk a bit about Jalen Hurts, just because, like, you know.
Like, what did he do
just
now? Like,
No, it's just the fact that he didn't, like, you know, hide on the sidelines afterward.
He
was very gracious, you know. He was out there congratulating Tua after every touchdown. You know, we could have easily, like, you know, gone into a corner, like never to be seen again. But also, he did the interview after the game, and he's like, you know, Tua did his thing and all that stuff. So I really respect him for that, even though, you know, that's got to be like crushing, considering he's been 25-2 over the last 27 games in Alabama.
I mean, there were plenty of people I know calling him out on Twitter afterwards saying, like, dude, why are you so happy? Like, that's because he's a great teammate. That's what teammates do. I'm sure you'd all agree.
And a national champion.
And a national champion. There is that.
That's the big thing.
That helps.
And they actually, Tua posted something on Twitter today where he said, like, you know, this guy's an amazing teammate. I don't know why, you know, everyone's giving him a hard time. The way he handled this, and we're teammates. We're great teammates together. And Jalen Hurts said, appreciate it. Hashtag national champs. That's the epitome of it right there. Like, I don't know how you could be upset after winning a national championship, even if you play the first half and another guy sort of steals the spotlight.
Okay, well, now we move on to our newest segment, The Bark, where we debate smaller topics and each participant will get a little bit of time to talk about each topic. So our first topic for the day is, with Braden Dickey transferring and Dante Pettis going to the NFL, who will be option number one for UW next year?
I might take the unsexy choice, the old standby. I think it's Aaron Fuller. He was solid his freshman year. Last year, he was sort of there. After John Ross and Dante Pettis and Chico McClatcher, it was sort of the second level, and he was kind of the main man there. This year, he stepped up. He led them in receiving. When with Pettis restrained by injury, he led them in receiving in the Fiesta Bowl. He had a good game against Stanford. He had a good game against Oregon. I don't know why he wouldn't be the number one guy going into next year. He's a good route runner. He's got good hands. He might not have the speed of a Savon Ahmed, but, I mean, he's a lot like Dante Pettis in my mind. I think he's going to take over for him. He has taken over for him in the punt return game. I think he'll do the same as the number one option.
I'm going to disagree. I think Fuller's going to have a really good year. I mean, I think he's going to be one of the starters out there. But my pick is going to be a little unorthodox. I'm going to go Hunter Bryant. I think Hunter Bryant is immensely talented. He had a really good true freshman campaign. And for a while, he seemed like the sort of number one option on the offense. With all that in mind, the fact that Will Dissly sort of had a breakout year this year as a tight end. And if Hunter Bryant can stay healthy the whole year, I'm going to go Hunter Bryant as the leading receiver.
I personally think it's going to be Andre Bocelli. Just because he had a bunch, you know, on third down, he seemed to be there when Jake Browning needed him. He had clutch plays all year. I mean, maybe the numbers aren't extremely gaudy just because, like, you know, people like Pettis and stuff take all those numbers. But I personally think that he's going to be really reliable next year.
I say one more thing. I think the question really isn't who's the number one receiver. I think the question is more who's the number two receiver, because we saw this year, like in 2016, one of the reasons that John Ross was so good was because he had Dante Pettis on the other side, which kept defenses from triple-teaming him. You needed to keep somebody deep on the other side to work with Dante Pettis. And this year, I think they sort of lack that. And that's one of the reasons that Browning and Pettis didn't... They had great years, but I don't think they had as amazing years, was because there wasn't that option to take some of the attention from the defense. So I think whether it's Bocelli or Fuller or Bryant or Pounds or Marquise Spiker or any of those guys, it really is going to be the balance that's key to the offense so much as the one guy at the top.
All right, our next topic is, did UW deserve a New Year's Six bid this year?
Yes.
Why?
I mean, are we talking in retrospect with what happened in the bowl games?
Yeah.
I think the answer is still yes. I think there were only a few teams that could argue with them, namely TCU, possibly Stanford, maybe Notre Dame. Stanford lost, so I think they're out of that discussion. And mm-hmm. I think TCU's body of work is a lot like UW's. They had the loss to Iowa State that they looked pretty not good in. They had two losses to Oklahoma. They had a semi-decent win over Oklahoma State. And other than that, their record is pretty much by the books. I think there's a lot in common with Washington. I think Washington's defense was better. I don't think TCU's offense is that much better. So I don't see any reason why Washington... I think TCU would have had pretty much the same result, if not a little bit worse, in the Fiesta Bowl. So I don't see why it should have been any different.
I think, and I do agree with you, actually. I do think UW deserved it. Just based on how they played this year, they had less losses. They hung in tough with Penn State. I agree that they belonged. But if I were to play devil's advocate, I would say that TCU beat Stanford. Granted, it was sort of a home game. They were playing in Texas, but they beat Stanford, and the Huskies lost to Stanford. So if you do the whole transitive property, there's that. But also TCU, I think, had a tougher schedule. Even playing in the Big 12, they lost to Oklahoma twice, which obviously doesn't look good. And in the last game of the year, they got blown out by Oklahoma. And obviously, the loss to Iowa State doesn't look good. But other than Washington State, who appeared to not look good in their bowl game, the Huskies didn't really beat anyone of consequence either. So I thought it was a sort of tricky situation. But ultimately, I do think UW deserved the bid in the end.
Yeah, I would also say that UW deserved the bid. Also, just because of the fact that, I don't know, USC, you know, Sam Darnold is obviously highly touted and stuff, but I thought they were sort of overrated. I would think from the start, I just don't think they really played like nearly as well as like you know, people said they were going to play, and I think they just continued to prove it as the season went along. So, you know, by that merit, I believe UW should, I still think they still deserve the New Year's bid.
And the thing about USC, too, was they won the conference, so you couldn't really deny them out of the New Year's 6 spot. But Ohio State was so much clearly the better football team on that day that, you know, that matchup, I could almost sort of feel going into it, it was going to be bad.
I think that says more about Ohio State than, I mean, there's a reason that a lot of people thought they should have been in the playoff. They were a good football team this year.
Yeah.
And I think they would have had the same result against probably pretty much any other team in the New Year's Six Bowls.
Except UCF.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I think I agree. I think Ohio State would have beaten anybody, and I felt like they sort of had to put that matchup together because it's like two blue bloods, Pac-12 champion against Big Ten champion, your typical Rose Bowl matchup, but instead in the Cotton Bowl.
All right, so our last topic for this new segment is who is going to start for the UW at quarterback in 2019?
I'll start on this one. You know, I really want to argue for one of the freshmen. I think all of them are insanely talented. Colson Yankoff's going to come in, and he's probably the most ready right now to play out of the freshmen because of his running ability. Jacob Sermon is another guy who's extremely talented. Watching tape of him, he can roll out to his left and throw the ball on a dime to receivers. And then Dylan Morris is going to come in, and he might be the best one out of the bunch. He's going to come in fresh, so I think it's going to be hard for Dylan Morris to win the job in 2019. Obviously, Jake Haner is going to be sort of the most experienced person in that group. He's going to sit at, 3 years inside the program, and that's invaluable experience. But ultimately, I think Jacob Eason, who's 6'5", 240 pounds, can throw the ball 50, 60 yards down the field, is going to be the guy. He was the guy at Georgia as a true freshman. He threw for over 2,400 yards, 16 touchdowns, to just 8 interceptions. Again, as a true freshman in the SEC against those defenses, I think Eason will win the job after sitting out 2018.
I think this is a great question. I think it's a tough question. I think Eason is the obvious answer, but I'll go against the obvious answer just for the sake of debate. I think the thing to think about is that Browning's going to start this year, and he's going to be gone after this year. And then you take the four other guys this year, so that's Eason and then Haner, Sermon, and Yankoff. By this time next year, all of them will have at least a year, two in the case of Haner, with the UW offense, and a year to learn from each other. So I think that sort of almost evens up the playing field, and it goes into who has the raw tools. And I think for that reason, I think Colson Yankoff has a really good chance, because you have a guy who's probably the most dual threat of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. That's something that the coaches will look for. He'll have a year under Jake Browning. He'll have a year. I think Jacob Eason's going to be a sort of teacher. I mean, you said he's got a year of experience against SEC defenses. He's going to give that knowledge to all the other guys. So you have a guy with a lot of learned experience plus the tools he has. I think that puts him in a good position. I think Eason's probably still the favorite, but I like Colson Yankoff's chances.
Look at me. I have no opinion. Just start someone named Jake.
I guess the last thing I could say about that, I think it also depends on what these quarterbacks have to work with. If Spiker is equally, if he's as good as he is advertised, and he can get down the field and he's going to be a downfield threat, if Trey Lowe is going to be a downfield threat, if Austin Osborne can get down the field like John Ross and Dante Pettis could in 2016, I think Eason is the guy. They're going to want a guy that can get the ball down the field like that. He's got the strongest arm. He can make things happen. He stands in the pocket. He makes pretty good decisions. But I think if it's another year like this year where Jake Browning's sort of by himself, you know, he had Dante Pettis for most of the year, but that was essentially it. Out of production-wise, Colson Yankoff's got a really good chance to win because he makes plays with his legs.
Especially with a tight end like Hunter Bryant. Like, those rollout plays, when you add the threat of the run from the quarterback, it's dangerous. I think the other question is talking about wide receivers and deep threats. Dante Pettis is gone. Who's going to be the double pass option now? Like, which of the receivers is going to be the one that's going to be testing out there on? Who do you think?
Andre Bocelli.
You think it's Andre Bocelli?
In that Penn State game, yeah, he threw a dime to Will Disley, who almost rumbled in the end zone. I think Andre Bocelli is going to be that guy.
All right.
What about you?
I mean, I still have to see the freshman. I haven't seen, we see all their tape, like Spiker and Osborne and Lowe. If one of them could throw, I don't know, maybe start them off early.
Yeah, you never know.
Thank you very much, Josh, for being on today as our first guest.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to being on soon.
All right, and now we will be moving on to our UW basketball segment on the men's side. We're going to be recapping the Wazoo game that happened last week and recapping last night's matchup against the California Golden Bears. Chris Ankiko, our beat reporter on the basketball beat, will go into that.
Thanks, Alec. Speaking of the Wazoo game, Washington used an 8-0 run in the last 2 minutes of the game to defeat its cross-state rival by a score of 70-65. They led for only 4 minutes in the course of the game, but clutch plays from Matisse Thybulle and Jalen Noel helped them seal the game late. The game started out really fast, actually. Wazoo led the game 16-12 after just over 4 minutes of play. The first five made shots were all threes, but then after that, the game started to slow down and get more physical, get more of the Apple Cup rivalry going. By the second half, it was very, when Washington would come back into the game, because Wazoo had leads for the majority of the game, obviously, they would build up, you know, around 5 to 10 point leads. UW would cut the deficit to 1, and then Wazoo would just build it back up. But that was the trend until basically the end of the game when UW came back. David Crisp, Carlos Johnson had some very clutch plays. And
that dunk, though.
The dunk. Oh, Carlos Johnson, he had some great plays. He had a few and one layups. That dunk, obviously, off the crossover.
It's like you said, whenever he finishes one, it's going to be big. Like,
yeah, it's always huge.
Yeah.
He doesn't always make them, but when he does, they're monsters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
If he can be that the sort of spark off the bench the rest of the year, like, UW's in pretty good shape. I mean, obviously, at the beginning of the year, he wasn't really doing all that much. I was really rooting for him to make some layups during the games, but obviously now he's coming more into his own, contributing more to the cause, and I think if that continues, it's definitely a good trend. Well, last night, the Huskies took a 66-56 win against California in their Pac-12 home opener. Freshman guard Jalen Noel continued his excellent campaign, scoring 20 points and 6-for-9 shooting. Noah Dickerson added 12 points and 6 rebounds, and junior guard David Crisp added 10 points. Cal had only one player go for double figures in this game, and that was freshman forward Justice Suing, who went for 27 points. Actually, their leading scorer, junior guard Don Coleman, who averaged 19.1 points per game heading into the game, was held to only 4 points on 0-4 shooting, and he was in foul trouble all game. There was a play in the second half where he committed a personal foul and a technical foul, already playing with 3 fouls, and he was immediately sent out of the game. He was never really involved to start out with, but it was an added boost that basically allowed the Huskies to take the game home at the end. Despite the fact that the Huskies won by double digits, it was a very sloppy game on both sides. Cal turned the ball over 18 times, and UW turned the ball over 20 times. Jalen Noel contributed 6 of them, and Coach Hopkins voiced his displeasure with his team's performance after the game. He talked about the fact he didn't think they played well. He didn't feel like there was a flow. It was really ugly. We got pressured. We had turnovers. So he's very dissatisfied with the game, and I think that really shows the bar he's set for this team this year, that he's not going to accept less than 100%. But the bench actually did contribute quite a bit to the game. Nas Carter had 10 points, one of his best outings of the season. Hamir Wright added another 2. Dominic Green added 3. And Michael Carter III returned from injury, really got big extended minutes. He played 16 minutes in this game. They were able to do that just because they had a double-digit advantage for most of the second half. So he was able to sort of flex his muscles and return from that hand injury and get extended playing time and experience on the court.
Yeah, I sort of think that whole bench thing is sort of interesting because they sort of have a different guy that comes off and like makes plays every game. You know, we talk about Hamir Wright. He did it in the Kansas game. He's been doing it pretty much all year. Dom Green did it against USC, and that was huge. And then just in this recent game, you get Carlos Johnson come off the bench and score, 10-plus points?
He scored 10 points.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's to have one of those guys go out and do that in each one of these games and not just focus on one guy being that guy off the bench is a really cool thing to have.
Yeah, but then you want some kind of consistency. Like, you don't want it to be kind of this pot shoot off the bench. Like, well, we got to get somebody and then they get lucky that somebody is playing well. You want to find that consistency so that you can start building that second unit around somebody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree. All the good teams have a guy that's going to come off the bench and do that for you. I also think it sort of speaks to Mike Hopkins and his coaching ability that he can identify the guy that's going to be good off the bench. Yeah, because he picks, you know, Carlos Johnson to get minutes, and then in previous games, he doesn't play at all. So the fact that he knows that Carlos Johnson's going to be sort of a matchup problem against Wazoo is really cool to see, and all these other guys. So I think that's something to look at as well.
Yeah, another thing, it encourages them to really take advantage of their opportunities. They probably know going in whether or not they're going to play, so the fact that they're really going out there and trying to show that they deserve the time is a really good sign to see, just for the character of the team.
Obviously, another big thing this year, obviously, you were mentioning Coach Hopkins, and you know the 2-3 zone has obviously been a huge, huge point of contention, obviously, this year. They've spent the whole season trying to like get it up and get it improving, and I think it's starting to pay like huge dividends, especially for Matisse Thybulle. He's, I believe, third or fourth in the country in steals. He averages around 3 steals a game.
Yeah.
He had 5 steals against Wazoo. I believe he had 7 in a game earlier this year. I forgot who that was against.
Was it Kansas?
It might have been Kansas. It might have been Kansas. But either way, his length is just... It's just too much. It's just proved to be too much. It's like the perfect weapon inside a zone. He gets steals, easy dunks. Nas Carter sometimes gets his hands in the passing lane. Basically, everyone gets a turn to take the ball away or trap somebody to get a steal. And it's worked out well. Points off turnovers is way up from last year.
Yeah, and I think he had a quote, too, about how instead of just going for steals like he was doing in the past, that now he's actually like just trying to sit in that passing lane, not go after everything, but like make sure that the defense is still there, that he's not overcommitting. So it's good to see that evolution of his play, too.
All right, and looking ahead to our Stanford matchup, Chris, what do you make of the Cardinal this year?
Well, the story of the Stanford Cardinal, they're teetering around 500. Obviously, they had that huge game, that weird game against USC where, was it Dejon Davis?
Yep.
He made that half-court shot, the buzzer beater, to win the game.
Former UW commit.
That's true.
Yeah.
So that was pretty...
Feels good.
That was pretty crazy. But yeah, they're teetering around 500. Their leading scorer is Reed Travis. He averages 20.7 points a game, which is good for 34th in the country. Dorian Pickens averages 12.5 points a game. He's only played 5 games because of a right foot injury. But he did score 26 points in the double overtime victory over UCLA. So that's something to look out for. They've played pretty good competition this year. They've lost teams like North Carolina, Florida, and Kansas. But they also have a few pretty bad losses to like Portland State and Long Beach State. Eastern Washington. They got their first ever win over Stanford this year, Long Beach State. It looks like a good matchup on paper for UW. I think they should win.
The other thing I'd say about Stanford is, yeah, they definitely like playing down low, but yeah, they can lose their concentration a little bit because more so than like those games, like because the game against USC was a great game, but the loss to Cal, they were beating Cal by 17 around halftime, and then Cal came back and won the game. That's not something you usually want to see from your basketball team. So I'd be a little worried if I was a Cardinal fan. I'd be worried about those last couple minutes too, because the last couple games it's been like an anything can happen.
Yeah, and also Cal has lost some pretty terrible games themselves. They lost to a Division II team, Chaminade.
Yep.
So that's pretty bad. They have a few other just absolutely resume-damaging losses, and the fact that they came back from 17 to win by 3 against Stanford just does not look good at all for Stanford.
I think these streaky teams are so dangerous. I really don't think there's like a truly bad team in the Pac-12. I think all these teams are talented. They have guys that can beat you. Anyone can beat you. I mean, it's basketball.
I think it's more of like a nobody's fantastic and nobody's terrible. Everyone's like in the middle.
Yeah, I think so. And that totally changes from last year where like Washington and Oregon State were awful last year and the top 3 teams, Arizona, Oregon, and UCLA were all in the top 10. This year, you're looking at like there's like 8 teams that have 2 wins and that's like second in the conference. So, I mean, it's still early. I think you're going to see some of these teams separate from each other. I think Arizona and Arizona State are both really good basketball teams and they're going to pull ahead. UCLA is a good basketball team. They're going to pull ahead. So
even if UW has just a bit over 500 in the Pac-12, maybe, as long as they're one of those upper echelon teams, I could easily see them. I don't know if in the bubble, in the tournament, I could see them going to the tournament. Now, I don't know how much noise they would make, but just them being in the tournament is a huge step in the first year of Mike Hopkins, considering where they were last year, having only won 2 conference games last year.
What is it, something like 7 years?
It's been a while.
Without a NCAA? I'm not sure.
It's been a while since Isaiah Thomas was here.
Yeah.
So. Was that the year they played, North Carolina in Sweet 16 or something like that?
Yeah. I think it's since 2011, because 2012 they made the NIT with a team that should have gone to the tournament. It was Tony Roten, Terrence Ross, CJ Wilcox, and they had like the first conference champion ever, at least regular season conference champion, to not make the tournament. It's been since that 2011 year, I believe.
Yeah, but honestly, like the prospects are looking pretty good. As long as they can take care of business against the lower tier Pac-12 teams and take a few games against like the likes of Arizona, Arizona State, if they can take 1 or 2 of those, I think they'd be in pretty good shape. With that, let's turn it over to Alec for a brief look at the rest of the sports going on here at UW. Alec, what's going on?
So, on UW campus, first we're going to be looking at the track indoor preview. It's the first indoor track action of the season for the Dogs. It's at the Dempsey Indoor Center this Saturday. It runs from about 9 to 6 o'clock. I'll be there. Then we're going to be looking at women's basketball, who's actually on the road against Cal and Stanford. Cal is going to be later tonight, and Stanford will take place on Sunday. The gymnastics team also makes its debut today on the road against Sacramento State. And lastly, the tennis teams in two separate places. The women's team is on the road. They're lucky for them. They're in Hawaii.
Jealous.
I'm majorly jealous. The men's tennis team is going up against Eastern Washington in their first action of the year. But that is at home, and it is tomorrow. All right, and now we move into our NFL coverage. We'll continue our playoff predictions. Last weekend, I had the best record of the weekend. I finished 3-1. We all picked the Chiefs wrong, so we all had at least one. Our buddy Andy finished 0-4 for the weekend.
Looking like the Browns out here.
He redeemed himself with a national championship game in college football, and hopefully he'll get back on track this week.
Chris, do I get finished a parade?
Yes, you get a parade.
Get an 0-4 parade?
If you win 1 week, we'll give you a parade.
Yes.
And a t-shirt.
A t-shirt. I'm in.
And Chris finished at 2-2 for the weekend. So this week, the first matchup will be the Atlanta Falcons, and they'll be taking on the Eagles in Philadelphia. Chris, what are your picks for this week?
Personally, in this game, I'm going to go with the Falcons. The Eagles with Nick Foles just don't look incredible. They just look like a different team. The Eagles are really going to have to rely on their defense if they want to win this game. Their season finale against the Raiders did not look very good. Nick Foles was abysmal, but the defense was the only reason that they won the game and that kept them in it. The line for this game is actually Atlanta by 3, so that really tells you something. I'm going to go with the line. I'm going to pick Atlanta.
I'm also going with Atlanta, but even if Carson Wentz had been healthy, this would have been a hard one for me. Personally, I feel like Philadelphia was a little overrated this season. They had a weaker schedule, and now that he's out, it's not looking good for them. And once again, we talked about it last week, but Sanu and Julio Jones are one of the best 1-2 receivers. I mean, I got that backwards. Jones is obviously number one. But it's just such a strong receiving core. Matt Ryan is an experienced quarterback. Took him to the Super Bowl last year. I mean, we know how that ended, but still, that's a lot of experience there. And yeah, I'm going to go with the Falcons on this one too.
I'm up, so I'll take a risk. I'm going to roll with Philadelphia. I think their defense is going to be the difference in this game. They had a stellar year. I think their defense was one of the biggest reasons why they finished with that kind of record. I think Atlanta is going to have trouble doing it twice on the road. Obviously, had to go to LA last week, and now they have to head up to Philadelphia in probably really cold conditions. So I'm going to roll with the whole home team. I think that last game of the year wasn't a great indication of what the Eagles can do. It was the last game of the year, and they'd already sort of secured that number one seed. So I think Nick Foles is going to play a lot better than he did. I think the running game is going to be good. Obviously, Alshon Jeffrey at receiver, a lot of playmakers on offense. I think they're going to pull out the win at home.
Well, here's the thing is that Atlanta is the only one of the six playoff teams that was in the playoffs last year. And, you know, they exhibited that experience against L.A. They dominated them on both sides of the ball. LA's offense didn't look the same. They were top five, obviously, scoring offense with Todd Gurley still at 100 yards, but it didn't matter because they shut down everything. Matt Ryan was on fire, and he was efficient. And it just shows, you know, obviously, even though they had that traumatic 28-3 Super Bowl experience, that they're still trying to recover from that, and I think they want to take those steps. I think they're super driven, and I think that's why I think they're going to take the win.
The other thing, it almost would have been nice for Philadelphia to have gotten to play last week just to, like, get into some kind of a rhythm with their offense so that Nick Foles can get more reps and everything. Because when teams get a bye, there's just something, they never come back as strong just because they've had this time off and you get like a little bit of competitive break, which, I mean, you should come back fresher, but at the same time, you lose a little bit of that competitive edge. So that could hurt them too.
I think the conditions are going to play a big factor in this game. It's going to be really, really cold. Atlanta obviously likes to throw the ball more than they have a good running back in Devontae Freeman, but I think they want to throw the ball first. I think that Eagles running game is going to get going with Jay Ajayi, Garrett Blunt. They have a lot of weapons in that backfield, so I think that's going to play a key factor. But honestly, I think this one's sort of a toss up.
It'll
definitely be a close one. We could all agree on that.
Yeah.
Oh, most definitely. With that, let's transition to the second game, which is the Marcus Mariota and the Tennessee Titans against Tom Brady and the defending Super Bowl champs, New England Patriots. The line on this game is New England by 13.5.
Oof. That's brutal.
Yeah, it's a big line. But personally, I want Marcus Mariota to go in there and beat the Patriots. But I'm not going to go as far as to pick them. So I'm going to pick the Patriots just because of all the experience, obviously, the Tom Brady. They're obviously dealing with a bit of controversy and, you know, with all the Garoppolo stuff. But, you know, it doesn't really seem to affect them all that much. And I think they'll put it all aside during, you know, game time. Patriots win.
It's the Patriots in the playoffs. You got to go with the Patriots. It almost doesn't even matter who they're playing. Yeah, they've got this little bit of side drama. I honestly think they don't care at all.
Yeah, it's same old, same old.
It's the same old. Yeah, exactly. This almost feels to me like a media attempt to try and make the Patriots, try and shake the Patriots.
Yeah.
And they just, it doesn't matter to them. It's the Patriots in the playoffs. It's Bill Belichick doing what he does best, which is win. So I don't see this going any other way than a Patriots win. I like Mariota. I think he's done a lot with this team. But yeah, I don't see them coming out with a win. Maybe they can make it close, but.
And the Patriots are at home. You know, that's not going to help the Titans. They're coming off a tough game last week, a road game against Kansas City, and probably a game that they shouldn't have won in the first place.
Can we just shout out real quick, Marcus Mariota just passed himself. That was one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
That was incredible.
It was great, but lucky.
Second quarterback in history or something, right?
Something like that. First time in forever.
That was his first playoff touchdown, right? He hasn't been to the playoffs, right?
Yeah, that was his first playoff touchdown.
Isn't that great?
That's incredible.
That's poetic.
So
that might be as historic as the butt fumble.
Unless they get maybe five of those plays in that game, it's not going to be close. In fact, I think...
Even with five of those plays, I don't even know if they win.
Maybe we should pick the over-under for this game.
Yeah.
And I'd probably take the over. I think it's going to be more than 13.
Over 13? Man.
I would also take the over.
I think it's going to be a blowout.
I mean, obviously, it's experience against, you know, a myriad of experience against youth and... That just doesn't, you know, stack up well for the Titans.
Last time we talked about this experience versus youth thing was with the Rams, and I said, forget about it. Like, the Rams are so dynamic that experience doesn't matter. I was obviously wrong because that game they got dominated. So, yeah, I think there's so many factors that just point to an obvious Patriots win. If the Patriots don't win this, that would be a terrible sign for their franchise. I don't see it going any other way.
Last note, the Titans went 3-5 on the road this year. In the regular season, and the Patriots went 6-2 at home.
It's going to be ugly.
Yeah. So with that, let's transition to Sunday afternoon game. First game will be the Jaguars against the Steelers. The line on that game is Pittsburgh by 7. We'll start with Andy. What do you think?
Well, when we talked about Jacksonville and Buffalo last week, we agreed it was kind of a toss-up, but we also agreed whoever won that game wasn't going to win the next game. And I'm sticking with that. The Steelers are going to win this game. I think Antonio Brown is back, right?
I think so.
Jacksonville, honestly, I feel like 7 is almost a little low. I would go over on that one for sure.
Yeah.
But all the tools, Ben Roethlisberger doing what Ben Roethlisberger does. I've got Pittsburgh all the way. And Juju, too. They got Juju Schuster-Smith.
Le'Veon Bell.
How could I forget about Le'Veon Bell? But they've got so many weapons on offense. And I feel like one thing you can always depend on with the Steelers is a strong defense. So... I feel like that's where I'm going with this one.
On a side note, did you see the Juju Smith-Schuster video where he goes out on the street as John Smith?
Yes,
which is
yes.
His real name.
Yeah.
It's John Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes out and interviews people about Juju's hit. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'd have to agree. I think you look at a Pittsburgh team that is right now, all the starters are on almost 3 weeks of rest. They rested that last game against the Browns and won anyway because it's the Browns. And then obviously had the bye. And that game last week between the Bills and the Jacks was just ugly.
It was unwatchable.
An ugly football game. This one's going to get ugly, too. I think the AFC is really a two-man race between Pittsburgh and New England, and I'd be shocked if it was anybody different.
Obviously, I don't know how much stock you guys are going to put into this, but these teams did play each other on October 8th in Jacksonville. This was in Pittsburgh, and Jacksonville beat Pittsburgh 30-9. Roethlisberger threw a career-high 5 interceptions. So if you've got any stock in that, that happened. But I agree with both of you guys. I mean, Jacksonville played an abysmal game. The defense is what's going to, you know, make or break the Jags. If they can force Roethlisberger into another 5 interceptions, maybe Bortles will have a chance if he gets the ball.
Did you guys see the thing about Bortles comparing himself to LeBron James?
Guys do that all the time.
I did not.
Let's just, like, back it up a little bit, yeah. Man. You won a playoff game against the Bills.
Yeah, a team that hadn't been there in, what, 15-some-odd years? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be rough for Blake Bortles against that defense. I just think, especially now considering the fact that they lost that game, I mean, they might pile it on.
Oh,
the Steelers might pile it on and be mad about that. So
That seems like something the Steelers would do.
So I think that's going to be another ugly one. Preparing for the death match between New England and Pittsburgh
that'll
to make
it
to the Super Bowl.
I don't know. I don't think it's going to be a very good game. I think last year they played and it was kind of a blowout.
Yeah.
That's for next week.
Maybe we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. This may come back to bite us.
Yeah.
It probably will in some way, but
I mean, if you go with me, it's going to come back and bite you. I'm just
That's true. Maybe it was come back to bite Andy and there's no one else. With that, let's transition to the final game of the divisional weekend, which is the New Orleans Saints against the Minnesota Vikings. The Vikings are favored by 5. Side note, if the Minnesota Vikings get to the Super Bowl, it'll be the first team to play it in their home stadium. So that'd be kind of fun. We'll start with Alec on this one. What do you think?
I think I'm sort of surprised Minnesota's favorite in this game. I know that their defense is one of the best in the NFL, and Case Keenum has had a really solid year for them. In fact, a really good season at quarterback for them, which is sort of shocking. But the Saints are playing so well. Drew Brees is obviously being Drew Brees. He has receiving weapons with Michael Thomas now and Alvin Kamara and Mark Ingram out of the backfield. They have a solid running game, a good offensive line with Max Unger at center. And their defense is playing pretty well. So I'm going to take the Saints, and I think they're going to actually win by a good amount. I don't think it's going to be a close one.
I think it will be a little bit of a close one. I think it'll be closer than you think it will be. I'm also going to go with the Saints because I like Drew Brees in the playoffs. I mean, talk about a clutch quarterback. Then the other, although I do think it would be cool to see Minnesota go to the Super Bowl and play in their home stadium. Like, how Vikings would it be for them to go to the Super Bowl and in their own stadium lose the Super Bowl? I feel like that, like, sums up the Vikings in as a franchise. Like, what is it? They've been to 4 Super Bowls and they've never won. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
They got destroyed in all of them.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I feel like that would be super Vikings, but I don't see them making it. The Saints will be a tough test. I think it'll be close, but Case Keenum, this is really his first good season.
Mm-hmm.
In the playoffs against the Saints.
Against a really good
team.
A good team.
A strong defense again. I don't see this going well for Minnesota. I think they could make it close and it could come down to the end, but I do like New Orleans in the end.
Gonna go into the minority here and pick the favorite. I'm gonna pick the Minnesota Vikings. I think Case Keenum has had obviously a revelation of a season. He protects the ball. He doesn't turn it over. He makes sure that at least they punt the ball back to their team and have the defense do the work.
Mm-hmm.
The Saints were also 4-4 on the road. Obviously, historically, the Saints haven't really been a road team. They are going to be playing indoors. Maybe that will be an advantage for the Saints. But the Vikings went 7-1 at home this year, including these two teams played in Week 1. The Vikings went 29-19. They obviously don't have Dalvin Cook or Sam Bradford. But obviously they've learned to live without Dalvin Cook, like, on their road to the playoffs. So I think the Vikings are going to win. So let's shift gears to an NFL team that's not in the playoffs. Your very own Seattle Seahawks, who have undergone a sort of house cleaning in their coaching staff. They fired offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel, as well as offensive line coach Tom Cable. Defensive coordinator Chris Richard is expected to be out as defensive coordinator, even though they have not officially fired him yet. Who knows where they're going to go from here? Brian Schottenheimer, I guess, is in talks to become the new offensive coordinator. That's not set in stone yet, but I guess the question is now, with all the coaching changes, will they just blow up their whole roster? Andy, we'll start with you.
I think they do need to start over. They have so much money devoted to their big defensive players who have served them so well, Cam Chancellor, Bobby Wagner, and all those guys. Like, they've definitely earned the right to be paid that much, but the Seahawks are in this weird transition phase, and at the moment, I would say blow it all up. I think it's time to just start rebuilding. The NFC West is going to get so much better next year.
Oh my gosh.
That I think that it right now might be the time to just kind of start over. Honestly, this feels a lot like the last days of Pete Carroll at USC. He was the guy, and then all of a sudden you've got Jim Harbaugh at Stanford, and you've got all these other teams coming up at him, and all of a sudden it feels like he's overwhelmed. And I mean, I don't know. I think that now might be the time to just start all over. But we talked about this last week. If you're going to tank, you have to tank right. You can't do the Browns tank, because that is not tanking right. You've got a good quarterback in Russell Wilson that, even with a not great team, you can still be relatively competitive to keep him to stay. But at the same time, we're talking more like getting older veterans while trying to build through the draft kind of a thing. The other thing they could do is start building through the draft and getting some like wily kind of like Moneyball veterans, and then try and attract some big free agent talent, because that's always a possibility. But yeah, I think now's the time. It's better to pull the trigger now than to wait too long.
I think, and that was the 49ers were one of those teams that just sort of meandered along until suddenly after an 8-8 year and they dump Harbaugh, they're the worst team in the NFL, or one of the worst teams in the NFL. It was like, boom. Because they, like you said, they sort of held on to some of those guys a little bit too long. They didn't really realize that the team was sliding.
They also have terrible ownership.
And their ownership was really bad. And I think the Seahawks are, you know, they Jeff Snyder, who's the GM, got a lot of credit for drafting well. He drafted Richard Sherman in one of the later rounds. Earl Thomas was an incredible draft pick. He had a few really good classes. But recently, yeah, they haven't gotten anyone. Shaq Griffin was good this year. But if you look at the rest of it, they picked Bruce Irvin, who sort of never really panned out. And
I would disagree with you on that. I think that Bruce Irvin, I mean, sure, maybe like the first year, 2012, he wasn't like incredible or whatever. But I think as he got older, he evolved. And that's why, you know, he got a bigger contract with the Raiders. And that's why he's there now.
I don't, but they used the 15th overall pick on Bruce Irvin. And he was like a situational third. He wasn't like Alden Smith. Like Alden Smith was dominant in those years with the 49ers. And I think they were sort of trying to make another Alden Smith. And he had like a second round grade on him. And, you know, and that was maybe a bad example because he did get sacks. But they've shown sort of this history in the past few years of really not being able to draft that well. So this year they have to really make a focus on getting a guy that's going to be really good for them at their position. I think they're drafting 18th. And not just spending it on an offensive lineman because that's probably your biggest need, but actually doing your scouting and making sure you're getting a good player. So I think it's going to start with that, but I think I agree that they're going to have to dump some of their larger contracts. They're going to have to bring in some fresh blood because otherwise these Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner days they're going to be gone quickly.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think last week, too, you talked about that. It's like, you know, this is the prime of Russell Wilson's career. So it's one of those, that's the biggest question in this is that how are you going to handle that? And the way they handle that, because obviously, you know, he's our big you know, money maker and obviously all this stuff, and he carries the team over 90% of the team's offense. So you really, what your decision here is going to influence. Maybe he leaves if you just tank the whole thing, because I don't think he wants to be here if he's not equipped with the players he needs to get to the playoffs. Because obviously that's all he knows, except for this year.
Yeah,
that's all he knows. And even, you know, we were a fringe playoff team, so obviously. You know, all of that.
Well, and guys say that they want to stay here, you know, through maybe one or two tough years. But once that third and fourth year rolls around where you're just at the bottom of the barrel, the guy doesn't want to be there. That's what happened again with the 49ers with Navarro Bowman. He'd sort of been there for 3 years and they were just the pits. And he's like, you know, I need to go to a team that's going to compete for a championship. I'm ruining the you know, the good days of my playing career. So that might happen to the Seahawks if they continue this downward trend.
And you want to introduce the NBA because you've been waiting for it for like 20 minutes.
All right, so now we'll move on to our NBA segment. Isaiah Thomas, UW's own, has been making some news recently for both good and bad, coming back from injury, and then,
And then that.
And then that.
And then the...
Who wants to go on what that is first?
Okay, I guess I will. Isaiah Thomas against the Timberwolves. Andrew Wiggins was driving to the basket, and then Thomas just sort of swung out his hand and hit him in the jaw.
Clotheslined him
in the jaw, got a flagrant 2 foul, was ejected. He wasn't having a great game to that point, but I think after the game, he was sort of like, I didn't mean to do it. But like watching the replay, it looked pretty intentional. I mean,
it kind of looked like Dellavedova's foul on Bradley Beal earlier in the week. Those were both really bad.
I mean, and the thing with the Isaiah Thomas thing was, like, he obviously wasn't going for the ball.
Oh, no.
Maybe his what he was trying to say was he was trying to stop Wiggins from getting the basket. And he is, I mean, he's short. Isaiah Thomas is short. So he sort of just swung and it hit him right in the face. But, I mean, that was bad and not a good look.
Wait, not at all. And then speaking of that game, though, the Cavs got blown out by almost 30. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have any? What do you guys think destroyed. Is going wrong with them right now? Because it looked like they had everything figured out, and now everyone's talking about, oh, look, IT's back. Like, the Cavs are going to be a force now. And since he's come back, like, he's been solid, but the rest of the team, Kevin Love's getting like 5 points a game.
He's disappeared.
What do you guys think has happened to the Cavs?
I think the leading scorer was Jeff Green.
Yeah.
I think he scored like 22 points.
Yeah, LeBron had 10.
Yeah, LeBron had 10. I think the rest of the starters went for single figures.
Yeah.
I really haven't watched enough of the Cavs to really know what like their big problems are, but obviously they need to right the ship. Obviously they have a lot of big name players. Obviously they're talking about that trade for DeAndre Jordan. Is that still like up in the cards, or like is that sort of like defunct now? Or?
No, I think it's still being talked about. I think Tristan Thompson also just wants to get to LA. He's got his Kardashian girl back there.
Yeah. But anyway, I think the big issue with the Cavs is they don't have a solid rotation. It wasn't like in years past where you can rely on Kyrie, you can rely on LeBron, Kevin Love's going to be a starter, Tristan Thompson's going to be a starter. Their starters were set in stone. And now they sort of, you know, Kyrie left, and now that this team is sort of in disarray. Like, you still have LeBron, and he's that stabilizing force. Jose Calderon has been in and out of the lineup at point guard. I mean, and, you know, Isaiah Thomas is probably going to come in and start, but he sort of throws that all in whack. You know, Jay Crowder's a good player, but again, I don't think the rotation's consistent. Whereas these teams, like, you know, we always go to the Warriors because they're the, sort of this shining example, but whenever KD goes out, they don't put Andre Iguodala in, even though he's their best small forward, aside from Kevin Durant. They put in Pat McCaw because it doesn't mess up their rotation. Andre Iguodala can still come off the bench, and I think the Cavs have that problem right now.
I think the other thing the Cavs have a problem with, and I've been hearing this from a couple of different sources, but they have no youth. In some of those games, like going up to Minnesota, like away, it's cold and everything. Like sometimes you need that young spark to like carry you through, that energizer, whether it be off the bench or in the starting lineup. And the Cavs are all getting up there in age. They're all either prime or a little bit past prime players. They don't have any of that, like, and I mean, the Cavs could also be suffering from what the Warriors suffer from time to time, just boredness. Mm-hmm. They know they're going to be in the playoffs. It doesn't really matter where they are.
It's like the Miami Heat syndrome.
Yeah, Miami Heat syndrome. They're just, and it could be that, but like you need that maybe youthful innocence almost to be excited for every game and to go out and play. And then the other thing I would say about the Cavs is maybe it's, and this is another thing I've kind of heard, but like it's a new team almost with Isaiah, and LeBron's new teams always need a month maybe to figure it out. So maybe in a month we'll be like, ah, remember when the Cavs weren't playing well? Like, look at them now. But at the same time, they do need to turn it around just because the Warriors obviously are so good. And it's not even just the Warriors. You got the Rockets, and you have, never count the Spurs out.
The and Thunder, the Celtics, the even Thunder in the East.
Celtics, yeah. Celtics are really starting, not starting, the Celtics look really good. The Raptors, still super underrated. The Miami Heat are coming out of nowhere. Like, Goran Dragic is averaging 17 points a game or something like that. The Eastern Conference is looking more competitive than it has in a while. And you've got the Washington Wizards, who are underperforming but are still always a threat. I mean, the Eastern Conference is starting to look more threatening than it has in the past. And the Celtics definitely need to, or not the Celtics, the Cavs definitely need to figure out where they're going with this team.
Also, they're getting smacked right now.
They are.
Yeah, by the Raptors. They're losing by, like,
30. I love the Raptors. I love me some Serge Ibaka.
They're losing by 30.
Serge Ibaka.
Isaiah Thomas has 4 points on 2 of 14 shooting.
Oh, that's rough.
But anyway, we can't say
that. Yeah, we can't
talk. We can't say that.
So next we're going to talk, we're going to stay in the NBA and talk about something Draymond Green, obviously, he's going to say what he thinks, said about the ref situation in the NBA. I'll read off the quote here. He said, "It's bad. It's horrible. It's really bad. I don't know why it is, but I think it's ridiculous. It's ruining the game. It should be one of, if not the main priority to be solved. It definitely should. They can get a new crop of officials, a whole new crop. Too many personal things are going on. Too much me against you. It just doesn't work that way." What do you guys think about that?
I disagree with the need a whole new crop of officials. First of all, like, there are a lot of good refs out there. We can all agree it's getting a little touchy, especially for players like Draymond and DeMarcus Cousins, who have reputations of being trash talkers and like loud, bad players, like mean players. I think there's definitely a little bit of the refs need to get over themselves. They're refereeing very, very competitive sport. They're going to be getting some jaw from players. They can't be holding them against them. And there definitely needs to be a little bit more of, it's a case-by-case thing, not a player versus referee thing. But at the same time, I don't think that a whole new refereeing crew is needed. First of all, that take a while to train up, and there are good referees out there. I don't think Draymond should just be generalizing all referees as bad just because he has some personal grudges against them. They also have their personal grudges against him, which, once again, should stop. But at the same time, I understand what he's saying, and I definitely can understand why he feels persecuted personally, because he leads the league in techs already, and he's missed a ton of time too, so he already has like 11.
He's 4 away from a suspension.
Already, and not even at the All-Star break. So I understand where he's coming from, but at the same time, I think there just needs to be some clarity between the refs and the players that maybe they should be doing on their own instead of kind of making this a national media
issue.
Yeah.
Here's the thing with like officials and officiating in general, it's always going to be a problem for somebody.
There's
always going to be a bad call or something, a missed call. It's just, I mean, it's just life, like, at this point. I mean, obviously, like, there are some very egregious violations and stuff like that, and maybe, you know, some calls should be, you know, go one way or the other, but the fact of the matter is, you know, it's just there. It exists. I think, personally, every time I've seen Draymond Green, I don't really watch the Warriors too often, but he seems to have a reaction to, like, every play. So, you know, honestly, I think those technical fouls are probably warranted. Obviously, I don't have enough experience to say that, you know. I mean, he just flails around. He always is, like, in people's faces. He's always in the refs' faces, and I'm surprised that they sort of don't team up more, just from what I've seen of him. That's just me, personally. Yeah, like I said, officiating is always going to be a problem. Draymond Green and DeMarcus Cousins obviously have reputations, but
I think there needs to be more clarity, like Andy was talking about, between, you know, what... One, what is a foul? Because sometimes you don't know. It felt like the NBA finals the past 3 years have all been called differently. In 2016, when the Cavs won, it seemed like they were calling much less fouls than normal. In 2015, it looked like they were calling more fouls than normal. And just game to game, it seems like these refs are just, I don't know, it sort of seems like it's inconsistent. And then on the player's side, talking with each other is good. I think Draymond making a big deal out of this and going to the media and saying it's a problem is not going to help anybody. Even though I think he does have a solid argument that these, you know, he's the one on the court, so he's seeing what's happening. There's got to be some personal things going on between these refs. I remember Sean Livingston was tossed from a basketball game for when a ref seemed like he was initiating contact with him. And there was the quote-unquote headbutt between the two. And Sean Livingston is one of the most quiet and humble players in the NBA. So I just think there needs to be more clarity between, you know, less parity between the officials and these players. They just need to talk it out.
The other thing I would say is, like, basketball is a passionate game, and a lot of the calls that I've been seeing recently have been stuff like someone, like, there's, like, they block them, but then there's a foul, and they're like, oh, and then there's, like, a player who, like, he'll make, like, some kind of a motion, and that gets you a tech. That seems really soft to me. Like, it's a passion. You don't want them to be out there looking like robots. The fact that they all play individually, like, they all have passion, like, they all let it out a little differently, like, but still, I think that has been a little soft from the referees. On the other hand, like, players shouldn't be getting
in the face of
officials all the time. Like, this is, I'm not sure if this is a thing in the NBA, but in the MLB, it's a thing. Like, if you touch an umpire, you're gone. You're hooked. And I think that's a solid rule, like, because in soccer, that's not a rule at all. And, like, you see players, like, get up and they'll start, like, they'll get right in the referee's face and start, like, kind of shoving him and stuff. And I don't know. I think that some of the calls have been soft for what techs are, but at the same time, players need to remember that they are the officials of the game.
The biggest thing I agree with Draymond in his quote is that he says it's one of the number one problems that needs to be solved. And I really think that it is. I think, you know, sometimes the NBA tries to get too focused. I mean, obviously up here in Seattle, we like the talks of, you know, an NBA team coming to Seattle and expansion and stuff. But the NBA has a lot of problems. There's issues that, you know, there's this super team issue where you get teams like the Golden State Warriors and Cavs who are in the finals for 3 straight years. It could be 4 this year. And then now this, you know, this referee issue that is an issue. I think that it's definitely something that needs to be addressed. And hopefully the NBA will do something about it.
All right, now that we're in the end of our NBA segment, let's throw it to Andy for our weekly soccer recap.
Now that we're starting to come back from the winter breaks, we've got a lot more soccer action happening. No EPL play this last week, but we did have some Carabao Cup action, also formerly known as the EFL Cup. It saw Man City beat Bristol City, who upset Manchester United in the last round. 2-1, Kevin De Bruyne scored again, because what else would you expect from him, before Bobby Reid tied it up. But of course, Manchester City never loses anymore. So Sergio Aguero in the 92nd minute, so in stoppage time with the winner. That puts Man City up 2-1 on aggregate. In the other leg, Chelsea and Arsenal played out a very boring, not interesting game at all at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea had 2 missed headers from Cesc Fabregas and Andreas Christensen. Either one, it just wasn't a great game. Jack Wilshere, I think, got injured again, which is not a surprise because he's always injured. And that was your action from England. La Liga came back this week. Diego Costa had the most Diego Costa kind of game. In his first game back in La Liga for his beloved Atletico Madrid, he helped them to a 2-0 victory over Getafe. Angel Correa scored, and Diego Costa, of course, scored before getting a second yellow card for celebrating with the fans and getting red carded. I don't know what more you can ask from Diego Costa. That's exactly how I want him to come back in his first game back for Atleti. In other La Liga news, Valencia beat Girona 2-1. A comeback win after Porto got Girona started in the 8th minute. Then an own goal from Romario and a Dani Parejo penalty sealed Valencia the win. They stay in 3rd place behind Atleti. Real Madrid suffered another setback. Gareth Bale's brace against Celta Vigo couldn't prevent them from drawing. As Daniel Vaz and Maxi Gomez scored, Real Madrid now sits 16 points behind Barcelona in a season where they were projected to win the league. This has been extremely disappointing for Los Blancos. They really need some new blood of any kind. They have no options off the bench. That's part of what's really killing them now. And then Benzema and Ronaldo are having two of their worst seasons together at the same time. In the Derby Sevillano, which is Real Betis versus Sevilla, Real Betis surprisingly thrashed Sevilla 5-3. For the people who aren't as big of La Liga fans, Sevilla is a perennial La Liga power, and Real Betis kind of yo-yo between La Liga and the secondary league. But Betis got the big win over their rivals, something that they will hold over the Sevilla fans for at least until the next time they play, probably longer. And Barcelona continued to roll 3-0 against Levante. Messi, Suarez, and Paulinho scored. They just continue to roll. And then we also had, from Spain, had some midweek Copa del Rey action. Real Madrid drew 2-2 to Numancia, who are in the second league in Spain. They're not in La Liga. Lucas Vazquez had a brace, and Guillermo had a brace for Numancia. But in the end, Real Madrid go through 5-2 on aggregate. Barcelona also won their match after being held 1-1 in the first leg by Celta. They destroyed the Galician club this time. Messi scored a brace. Jordi Alba had a goal. Luis Suarez, Ivan Rakitic. All while new transfer Coutinho watched Barcelona look absolutely unstoppable right now. They are legitimate threats, again, like always, to the Champions League and are looking like they're going to run away with La Liga. This week also saw the return of French football. PSG, the French League isn't even interesting anymore. PSG are absolutely running away with it. In the Coupe de France, they won 6-1 against Rennes. Mbappe, Neymar, and Di Maria all had 2 goals each. Monaco are still hanging around. They beat a team whose name I can't pronounce. 5-2.
You gotta try. You gotta try.
Okay, it's a Y-Z-E-U-R-E. If you guys want to try it. Izure? I don't know. I'm going to guess that's what it is.
Let's put that one in the description and see what we get.
Carrillo had a hat trick. Jovetic and Fabinho also scored. And then they also had some Coupe de la Ligue action. PSG beat 10-man Amiens 2-0. Neymar again. Rabiot. Honestly, having Neymar on a team in the French League is just absolutely unfair. He is next level. If PSG win the Champions League, he's going to win Ballon d'Or. Quote me on that. Messi's having a fantastic season. Ronaldo's not having a good season. This is Neymar's time to really take over. This is why he left Barcelona, to be the star. And he's with PSG, it's not even fair. Serie A continues to be the only really interesting league. Juventus beat Cagliari. Bernadeschi scored a late goal to give the old lady the win. But Paulo Dybala, who is just starting to find some kind of form, limped off hurt. I believe it's a hamstring injury. Napoli continued to roll too. Kalidou Koulibaly and Jose Callejon scored against Verona to give them the 2-0 win. Roma stumbled in their first game back from the winter break. Edin Dzeko scored, but Cornelius and Darun scored for Atalanta, who went down to 10 men, but Roma couldn't take advantage, giving Atalanta the win. Inter Milan 2 lost points after drawing with Fiorentina. Mauro Icardi scored to give Inter the lead, but in the 91st minute, Giovanni Simeone, the son of the Atletico Madrid coach, scored to give Fiorentina the draw. Additionally, Lazio won 5-2 against SPAL. Ciro Immobile had 4 goals to lift Lazio over their in-city rivals Roma into that 4th place, meaning that the table in Italy now stands Napoli at 51 points, Juve at 50. Inter's dropped off in the last couple of weeks at 42. Lazio sits at 40, 1 point above their hated rivals Roma in 39. In transfer news, obviously the big one is Coutinho to Barcelona for 145 million euros, plus add-ons that could eventually take it to 160, making him the second most expensive player in history until Mbappe officially goes to PSG this summer from Monaco. Diego Costa's move became official, 59.4 million euros. Vitolo also was officially made a member of Atletico Madrid for 40 million. They both signed in the summer, but because of Atletico's transfer ban, couldn't play. Barcelona also brought in Yerry Mina, a super tall, just weird kind of player, Colombian defender from Palmeiras, for 11 million. And Chelsea brought in Ross Barkley because they need more central mids, I guess, for 15 million. And that wraps up our soccer take for this episode.
To end our show, we're going to just go in a little bit of news about the Washington Huskies mascot, Dubs, our live mascot. 2018 will be his last football season with the team. He started in 2009, succeeding the previous UW mascot, Spirit. And the next mascot will take over in the 2019 football season, and he will be named Dubs 2.
I wish we were going back to the regular names. I like the different names.
I agree, but I will welcome Dubs 2 with arms. I'm sure he will be amazing. Thank you for listening to The Box Seat. This has been Alec Dietz,
Andy Amashta,
and Chris Sankiko. If you want to join the conversation on Twitter, please tweet us at Box Seat Podcast. Thanks again, and we'll see you next Friday.
For more like this and other great shows covering sports, science, relationships, and the arts, visit the Soundbites website, uwpodcast.com. That's uwpodcast.com.